And thank you for joining us for another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. We are committed, as always, to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And honestly, today I am so excited to do this podcast because the person that I'm going to interview, though I've never met her before, has become sort of a hero to me. Reading her book was absolutely intoxicating. She was able to communicate salient truths and do it in such a way that you could not only understand them intellectually, but emotively. So anyway, I'm just delighted to be able to bring Bethany Mandel to you. She is a contributing writer, an editor, a columnist. She's written for the New York Times, the New York Post, the Washington Post, the Washington Examiner, Newsweek, Spectator, and much more. She is also, and I think this is the interesting part for this Hank Unplugged podcast, she's the co-author with Carol Markowitz of Stolen Youth, subtitled How Radicals Are Erasing Innocence and Indoctrinating a Generation. And when I think of generation, I sometimes think about what Jacob Neusner said. He, of course, one of the most published authors in all of history. He said that civilization hangs suspended from generation to generation by the gossamer strand of memory. And he went on to say, if only one cohort of mothers and fathers fails to convey to its children what it has learned from its parents, then the great chain of learning and wisdom snaps. If the guardians of human knowledge stumble only one time, in their fall collapses the whole edifice of knowledge and understanding. And I think that applies to the woke worldview crisis that Western civilization is experiencing today. And as I said at the very beginning, Bethany Mandel has written about this eloquently and instructively, a book that we make available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. It's called Stolen Youth. You can get your copy for just standing with us. We're not putting a price tag on it. Stand with us shoulder to shoulder in the battle for life and truth. You can get a post office box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271, or just go to the web at equip.org. With that, by way of introduction, Bethany, I am just delighted to meet you and have you on this podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. What an introduction. I feel like I'm going to replay that at my funeral.
Well, I mean, you're an inspiration in many ways. I have 12 children. We have 9 natural and 3 adopted. You have 6, and you actually intentionally have 6 at this point because you want to bring a lot of life into this world.
I do. I don't know if I would say intentionally on all 6.
No, I mean, you wrote an article about that. I never wanted kids, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I wrote a piece for the Free Press a couple of months ago saying exactly that. I had lived my life imagining I would never have kids. And it's funny, my co-author, Carol Markowitz, she felt the same. We both felt like we were going to be these old dames sitting and smoking a cigarette in a hotel bar. And, you know, who needs kids? They're like a ball and chain. And our hearts got changed, I think mostly when we met our husbands and sort of grew up a little bit. But I'm so thankful that I made that realization when I did. Carol was a little bit older than me when she made it. I think that she would have more if she had made it a little bit earlier. But yeah, no, I couldn't imagine, especially 6, like what an excessively absurd number.
So right now you're doing a podcast and you're multitasking like a lot of women are very good at. My wife does it all the time. You're doing a podcast and taking care of your 6 children at the same time.
Mostly, yes. Yes. There's some screens involved. My kids love when I do these things because they're like, ooh, excellent screens in the middle of the day on a weekday. Because I homeschool as well, so everybody's got to be occupied.
You know, this is probably a strange way to start a podcast, but I'm going all the way to chapter 9 of your book, titled In Praise of Resiliency. I thought that was one of the most brilliant chapters in the book. A chapter in which you point out that wokists want people to be victims. They want to dismantle society in order to rebuild it. And you use the story of your mother's death and used it powerfully to point out how she challenged you to be more than a victim.
Yeah, and at every step of the way, I mean, so my mother was very liberal, but praised herself on her own resilience. My mother also did not have an easy road. And she knew, because she was sick, she knew that I would not have an easy road. I was estranged from my father and she was sick, and we knew that she wasn't going to live past. We knew that we would be lucky if we had her at my high school graduation, and we ended up not having her there. I was estranged from most of my very small family. And so she knew, like, I would really have to be very tough in order to survive what we both knew was coming down the pike. And so she raised me really tough, with no excuses, no whining. And I thank God when she died, and then when my father died several years later, in these separately very tragic ways, 2 years apart when I was still a teen, I had a therapist who said, like, you could just wallow and, like, become a drug addict and no one would be surprised and no one would really blame you. But is that what you want to do? Is that who you want to be? And I think now about sort of how therapists message resilience and moving on and just mental health in general. And the goal isn't to get people out of therapy. It's to sort of make them into lifelong patients. I mean, that behooves them financially for sure. But we've sort of moved on from a model where people are trying to survive and thrive. And you get a lot more points and credibility among your peers, especially when you're younger, if you keep on messaging the bad and you dwell on the bad. One of my favorite sort of ways to describe how I survived that time of my life was fake it till you make it. And every day I woke up and, like, hyped myself up into just faking it until eventually it wasn't faking it anymore. And that line of, like, when did it stop being fake is unclear to me, but it was a slow process. And eventually I sort of was like, okay, I can do this. I can sort of function without lying to myself all day, every day.
I want to talk, Bethany, about this word woke. That's the heart, that's the essence of what you're writing about in your book. When I think of the word woke, I always think of an acronym, a worldview war, the W for the heart and soul of Western civilization. The O, I think about that oppression, oppressed matrix that's very Marxist, but now has become far more broad in terms of its use in Western civilization, where it's systemic in all of our institutions. And then the K, which you do the best job of, you show that kids are the target. And then the E, the extremism. The extremism is the new reality. Extremism in entertainment, in education, in the environmental industry. But that's my way of thinking about the word woke. What do you think of when you think of woke, particularly when it has a denotative meaning and a connotative meaning? The denotative meaning is very different than the connotative meaning. And in many ways now, people like AOC are saying that woke no longer applies as a word. It's been co-opted by the radical right.
Right. So, I mean, she doesn't want us to use that word anymore because they messaged it for so long. And it, when people realized what it actually meant, it became deeply unpopular. And so that's sort of why they're trying to run away from it and redefine it. I went viral right when the book came out because I had, like, sort of this brain fart moment where I stumbled on defining it. And partially because I had a newborn and hadn't slept in 4 days, but partially because it is a hard word to define. It is a hard system to define. I think that you hit on a lot of the important parts, this idea that there are oppressors and oppressed. And the origins of the phrase do start with the Black community. And, you know, you have to awaken yourselves to the realization that America is built on racism. That's the 1619 Project. And that you have to awaken yourself to the fact that everyone is either an oppressor or an oppressed, and that is predicated upon one's race or gender identity, whatever, immutable characteristics. Except when it comes to gender, that is very, you can change that at a whim. But this idea that it's oppressor and oppressed based on race or gender, and also that this is a society that needs to be broken down and completely reimagined and completely sort of wiped clean. And so we're seeing that in how these activists are trying to change our society in the most basic of ways, redefining what is a woman, what is a man, what is the origin story of our country, who are the heroes and who are the villains, what does it mean to be a hero, how does one become a hero. Frederick Douglass is having his statues torn down alongside Confederate soldiers. So this sort of wiping clean of history and wiping clean of definitions, it's very Marxist, but it's culturally Marxist.
Yeah, that's well said. One of the things that really caught my attention as I read your book is the indication that you had lived in Cambodia. I've spent a good amount of time in Cambodia as well. And when you see what happened in the Khmer Rouge, I'm sure you've seen the monuments with the glass and you see all the skulls and the bones and so forth. And you lived there, and now you see that Marxist ideology that killed, what was it, 2/3 of the population. You see that now in the place that we call home.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that what's disturbing about it is, you know, this idea sort of, it's a joke, but it's not really a joke. The thing that people say over and over and over who support this worldview is, well, real communism has never been tried before. But they don't understand the history of how they tried it and how it went awry. And this is partially why they're trying to wipe clean history and not teach history and not teach literacy and all of these things, because you need an ignorant population in order to try to advance these theories. And in Cambodia, that was the basis of what they did. Everyone who had a college degree, who had an advanced job in engineering or medicine, even if you had glasses, you were immediately killed. You were a number one target. And, you know, that's not happening here. But the indoctrination is happening to that upper class of intellectuals. And they're not killing them, but they're making sure that there's no way you can possibly come out of that sector of our society without completely having a buy-in. And that you're unable to question the worldview that's placed in front of you, oftentimes by fear. The groupthink that is prevalent among academia and sort of the elites is such that people feel like they are risking their entire livelihood and their reputation and their lives if they do speak out against this.
One of the brilliant aspects of your book, Stolen Youth, and again, when I say brilliant, I think this is a brilliant book, and I read a lot of books, so I've written quite a few books, and I read a lot of books. I think this is a brilliantly written book. But I think part of the brilliance is that you've identified with the title what the issue is. The title is Stolen Youth. And there is a brazen attempt to cut parents out of the educational process. The state is now educating kids instead. And this is something that you can either capitulate to or you can stand against. And if you don't stand against this, we're going to fall as a civilization. I start out with that Jacob Neusner quote for a reason. If that gossamer strand snaps one generation and you become like Rome.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's that famous Ronald Reagan quote, freedom is only one generation away from extinction. It's the same idea. And we're seeing it in, you know, just basic literacy rates. You know, we kind of have to question all of these things. We have to step back and think, what do we want America to be? And I think that Tucker Carlson's speech at the Heritage Foundation right before he left Fox News was really fascinating, because he said, you know, it used to be that we all felt like we were on the same page. We all believed in the same things. We all wanted the same ends, and we all came at different directions in order to arrive at that same conclusion. And that conclusion was, you know, a powerful and moral country filled with, you know, moral individuals who were helpers. And, you know, but now, I don't think that's the case. I don't think that large quantities of the left want, I mean, I would say anyone on the left, honestly, want us to be the most powerful country in the world and that we are the most moral country in the world. We saw that way back in the Obama days with his Cairo speech. They are afraid of sounding too nationalist, too xenophobic. I'm not sure what it is, but they are afraid to just stand up and say, we live in a wonderful country and we are blessed to be here. And instead, you know, we're all miserable. We live in a racist country that was built on the backs of slaves. and we're all just sort of like become a little bit more philosophical. We're all just biding our time until we die on this rock and then we turn into dust because there is no God. I mean, that's a lot of this too, is just this faithlessness on the left that we're all just spinning on this rock until eventually we croak.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I mean, I think that wokeness in and of itself is an attack on religion, an attack mm-hmm. on there being something more than just molecules in motion. One of the points that you and Carol make so brilliantly in chapter two is how wokeness had its heyday in the midst of pandemic. In other words, pandemic actually worked well in favor of wokeness.
Don't let a crisis go to waste.
Yeah, never let a crisis go to waste.
Yeah, so I mean, that was sort of the moment that we opened our eyes and realized that we had a phenomenon on our hands. It wasn't a lot of isolated incidents. And that's why we wanted to write this book, because we wanted to sort of clue everyone else in on this realization that we had, that everything that's happening, all of these, like the videos that you see on libs of TikTok or the news stories you see about the statues getting torn down, your kid that came home singing swish, 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 go the drag queen's hips because that's what his librarian read to him in kindergarten during read aloud story hour that day. All of these things are interconnected and they are all part of the same phenomenon. And it really accelerated during COVID. But it didn't just accelerate, but it also became a sort of a blessing in disguise, because parents were able to see for the first time, like literally have a window in their living room into the classroom, and they realized, like, I'm sorry, what are you learning? And as a result, there were a lot of attempts on the parts of teachers and administrators to say parents aren't allowed to observe, parents aren't allowed to be in a room. There were instances of teachers and administrators trying to ensure that the Zoom classes that kids were taking part in couldn't be recorded and weren't allowed to be observed. And that is, I mean, anyone that is familiar with childhood sexual abuse and sexual grooming knows is a massive red flag. And, you know, that term groomer has been thrown around, in my opinion, way too flippantly. And everyone who participates in these conversations with children has been labeled a groomer. That, I think, is excessive. And I think that that's an overstep. But it is actually grooming, whether they mean it to be or not. They are desensitizing children to having inappropriate conversations of a sexual nature with people outside of their immediate family. And then they are told to keep those conversations a secret from their parents or from their guardians. So whether the people who are doing that mean to or not, they are grooming them either for sexual abuse now or sexual abuse later.
Yeah, I want to get into that some more later on. One of the questions I have for you, Bethany, and you probably have your finger on the pulse as well as anybody in this regard, and that is apathy. And here's what I mean. My parents fought in the Dutch underground. I'm from Holland. And one of the things that they often talk to me about is, in essence, the smoke wafting over the steeples of churches and people being apathetic to the fact that there were thousands of people being incinerated in crematoriums. And in some way, it seems to me that there's an apathy in our culture when you have mass experimentation on kids of the most grotesque fashion, and people in positions of power are looking the other way, because if they say anything, they're going to lose their livelihood. If you don't go along with the woke culture, you can't get a publishing contract. So people are saying, look, I'm going to look the other way, not realizing that this looking the other way could cut short the life of Western civilization. And one other thing I want to say in this regard before you comment, I have spent a lot of time in Eastern regions and seen wonderful things that are happening in terms of revivals and so forth. But one of my good friends who was the hatchet man for Nixon, Chuck Colson, always used to remind me, Hank, we can't lose Western civilization. Anyway, back to apathy.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's something that Carol and I experienced. We were trying to pitch this book project amid a time when Abigail Schreier, who wrote Irreversible Damage, was being targeted by big tech. She couldn't run Amazon ads. She was taken off of the Target website. And so there was fear among publishers at that moment when we were pitching this book idea that we would finish the project, they would pay us a not insignificant advance, and then they would literally be unable to sell it because they couldn't place it on Amazon or whatever. And so even among conservative publishers, there was a great deal of fear about this. And we were asked by one publisher, can you take the transgender stuff out of it just so that we know that we're safe on that front? And we said, absolutely not. That is such an integral part of this book. We would be embarrassed to write it while completely ignoring that massive elephant in the room. And, you know, every source that I spoke to said, it's subtle, it's insidious, but on this area, it is overt, it is aggressive, and it is accelerating at a really rapid clip. And I think it's because I think that people on the left realize that it is an unpopular ideology, and they have to message it so that people are scared to speak up before everyone starts realizing that the emperor has new clothes, before people start talking and sort of being more brave to speak up. And I think that we might be reaching that moment. There was a great piece on the Commentary Magazine blog by my friend Abe Greenwald the other day, and the topic of the piece was like the transgender bubble burst. And he sort of cites statistics in recent polling data that indicate that fewer people are accepting of this ideology than ever before. And also the Bud Light controversy with Dylan Mulvaney was, I think, a Rubicon moment. I think that a lot of people had a collective look around the room and realized, like, this is where we're going to take our stand. And it's a weird stand to take with a crummy beer, having like this not even paid spokesperson do one ad. Like, it was a strange hill to die on, but a lot of people died on that hill. And for the first time, I think a corporation was really made to feel the heat on standing behind this ideology. And it will give other companies a real significant pause if they want to jump to this culture war in the future, because they see what's happening to Bud Light sales.
Yeah, but let me push back on that just a little bit. This doesn't mean that I'm disagreeing with what you're saying necessarily.
You can disagree.
You know, of course. But, you know, there's this gender-affirming care, for example, mm-hmm. as a moniker, and it's masking mass mutilation, and that mass mutilation is being endorsed, I think that's not too strong a word, by both major teachers' unions.
Yes. No, it's really disturbing how this, I think that one of the biggest weaknesses for people on the right is our inability to message appropriately and message effectively. And so we have let the left message what this is. Gender transformation and all these things has become gender-affirming care. And it's been placed in a positive light in a way that we never should have allowed it to be. And I think that there's some really powerful voices that are emerging among individuals who have had this experimental medical care and who are suffering from the effects of it. And they're literally showing the visual representation of, like, I am incontinent. I will never be the same. This is my voice. And I now identify with, you know, my biological sex again, and I am forever maimed. And I think moving forward, the right absolutely needs to stop using that framing of gender affirming and really amplify the voices of these individuals who have been irrevocably damaged by the experts around them, who all told them, you know, this is what you can do in order to be happy and to be healthy emotionally and physically.
You know, one of the sinister aspects of all of this is that it becomes a $1 trillion business when you think that kids mm-hmm. have this mutilation that takes place, whether it's hormone therapy or it's top and bottom surgery or whatever it happens to be. This kind of tampering with biology makes those kids patients for life.
Yes, exactly right. There is a significant financial incentive at play here among the medical establishment to create lifetime patients. And I'm not one to cheer socialized medicine, but this, I think, is the difference between Europe and America. In Europe, they are stepping back from this because they're realizing this is going to cost the state, the collective, you know, society a great deal of money. And we're not seeing positive effects enough from this to justify this expense. Whereas in America, I think that what it's going to take in order to put a stop to this is lawsuits, like we saw with big tobacco.
One of the things that you say in this book, along with Carol, is that schools have become brainwashing centers. That's a strong statement, but I think it's a statement that needs to be made. I walk every morning and I see the kids, they're looking at their iPhones or whatever kind of smart device they have. They're waiting for the yellow bus to pull up. And so often I can't help but thinking, oh my goodness, these kids are being indoctrinated on their way to school, and then they're going to an indoctrination center on top of that. Is that too radical? Is that too strong from your perspective?
It's not, but I think that schools are obviously not very good at their jobs, or we would be producing people who are a little bit more literate. I think that they've shifted their focus away from producing individuals who are, you know, basically literate to who are sort of able to parrot all of these talking points that they're shoving down their throats. But I don't even think that they're that effective on that front. I think that their hope is to be much more effective than they are, is what I'm saying. What I think is most troubling and disturbing about this sort of indoctrination attempts is actually through TikTok. I am a full-blown conspiracy theorist when it comes to TikTok. I think that it is a Chinese mind control device. If you look at the difference between American TikTok and Chinese TikTok, the messaging that's happening on those platforms is disturbingly different. In China, they are using these short videos that are shoved at children and teen brains that are about resilience and hard work and trusting the state. And that's the messaging they're trying to put forth for Chinese teenagers who have these devices. For American teenagers, they're trying to turn them into basket cases, and they're very effective. They're very good at it. There was a Wall Street Journal piece a while back that indicated, like, you know, they're able to track the videos that you're spending like milliseconds more watching and realize patterns of preference for users and then continue to feed that content over and over. And it's mind control. That's how they're sort of changing these developing brains in order to be more susceptible to messages about transgender ideology, violence, sex, pornography, you name it.
Let me read something from your book, a short piece, but this has to do with Ibram X. Kendi. You point out in the book, I think succinctly and adequately, that there's a lot of hucksterism going on where people like Kendi are being paid huge fees for racist ideology. For example, this hits close to home. Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, we're in Mecklenburg County, in North Carolina, paid Kendi $25,000 fee, and then God knows how much to buy his books, to give a talk on how to be an anti-racist.
Mm-hmm.
And he overtly says in his talk that you got to combat past racism by being racist today.
Yes. Yes, you have to create segregated schools in order to combat racism. There's a lot of segregation at play here in order to be an anti-racist, which is sort of a funny dichotomy. But I was joking with a friend the other day. There's someone on a board of directors of an organization that I once respected, and they hired someone based on her DEI qualifications, not on her actual expertise. And she's making a great deal of money. And I thought to myself, I should have pulled a Rachel Dolezal and completely changed my own personal professional trajectory in order to just be one of these hucksters, because there is so much money. And you don't even necessarily have to hit the DEI checkpoints. You just have to claim that you do, and no one will ask any questions.
How critical is critical race theory or critical theory in terms of its imposition of worldview on the school systems?
So the school system, for better or for worse, is very hyper-localized. And so the school system that you're seeing in North Dakota or in Florida is very different than the school system you're seeing in Vermont or Rhode Island or New York. That being said, what is being taught in teachers' colleges, and Carol's chapter on this was really powerful, what is being taught in teachers' colleges that is then dispersed nationwide is cultural Marxism, is critical race theory. And a lot of it is also embedded within textbooks and in AP courses. So one of the more powerful things that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis did with the advanced placement test was that he said, like, we're taking critical race theory out of these textbooks. And people were like, you're trying to take Black history out of Florida and, you know, keep children ignorant about the evils of slavery and the Jim Crow era. And he said, no, I'm just taking out the critical race theory. And we'll still teach about slavery. We'll still teach about segregation, but we're not going to teach them that the solution to all of those things is reparations, which is currently in the advanced placement exams and materials. And so DeSantis was able to really shine a light on exactly what was being taught. And it sort of, it harkens back to that earlier, like how they're messaging gender affirming care, like all of Black history and Black theory and all of these things is being packaged within a critical race lens. And so you can't separate it out. It's all packaged together. And that is the messaging that's happening. Even within the homeschool community, you'd be surprised as to how these like little pockets of experts are sort of messaging this ideology, even to unassuming homeschool mothers who are like, I want to provide my child with a full education. When, I mean, and I feel this way also as a homeschool mother, I want my children, when we're learning about the founding, to also learn about the evils of slavery. That is part of the American story. It's not the whole part. It's not the reason that we exist as a country, but it is an important thing that they need to learn. And it is increasingly difficult to find materials that do not tell these stories from a critical race lens.
You know, when you think about education, we're talking about it sort of on the elementary level, kids being the target and all of that. But Yomi Park, she wrote a book and has done a lot of podcasts that I've listened to. And one of the things she points out is that she experienced this phenomenon in higher education at Columbia University. Mm-hmm. I mean, here she is in a university. She comes from North Korea, and she is taught not to think in that university, but rather to parrot a narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what to think instead of how to think.
Yeah,
I had that experience as well. I feel like one of the things I learned in college was how to fight. I was in a 101 class in my history department, or maybe it was a 200 level course. And my professor would make these like sweeping assertions about, you know, not all women in hunter-gatherer societies were the gatherers, and sort of trying to interweave feminist modern ideology and transpose that onto ancient humanity and prehistoric peoples. And that was the course. It was about prehistoric humanity and peoplehood. And I would raise my hand and say, where are you getting that from? Like, I did the reading. Where are you getting that from? Is there archaeological records? Like, where does this information come from? And she stopped calling on me, and I just kept my hand up the whole time and was obnoxiously, like, I was that kid in the class. And I would go up to her afterwards and I would say, like, I'm not going to put this in my exam because you've never given me evidence of this assertion. And so I would write that on my exams when she would have pointed questions about, like, what was the role of women in this prehistoric society? I would say, I've seen no evidence to give me an answer. And she would give me a zero on that section of the exam. And I brought it to the department head. And I said, like, I would like to see the evidence. I asked for it in class. I have witnesses in the class that showed I asked for evidence. And I was never provided with the evidence. So you cannot give me a zero on this question. I understand what she said, but I was never shown evidence for that. And it became such a battleground between the two of us, the professor and myself, that she just ignored me and stopped trying to fail me. And I stopped going to her boss and complaining about her. And I got a B+, and we both moved on.
You know, what's interesting about that story is you were trusting your own intuitions to some extent. In other words, you were listening to something and intuitively you're saying, you know what? I don't know if that's true. And I'd like you to expand, as you do somewhat in your book, on how we have to teach our children to trust their deepest God-given instinctual intuitions about reality.
Yes, absolutely. So I've recently signed my oldest daughter up for a sleepaway summer camp. And one of the questions on this like parental thing about sort of who the children are, like their interests, whatever, one of the questions said, how has COVID affected and impacted your child. Because in a previous communication from the camp, they said, last year we had a lot of traumatized children coming to camp, and their parents never disclosed the traumas that they experienced. And it made for a very difficult camp experience because we didn't know what we were getting until the first day of camp. And it was deeply unfair to everyone involved, camper and counselors alike. And so they sort of sent this questionnaire of, like, you know, alongside, like, what interests your child? Do they like dance, like art, whatever? The question about COVID was on there. And I said, it made her deeply distrustful of authority. That was COVID. That was the lesson of COVID for my children. And, you know, we read a book about dinosaurs and they say, oh, the dinosaur could swing its tail 65 miles an hour. And I would say to my child, do you think that we know that? Do you think that that's something we actually can know based on, you know, they said 2 pages earlier that the only thing we have from this dinosaur is 4 bones, not in its tail. So how do we know how fast its tail swung? But there is this effort to raise children who are not critical thinkers. And at the end of the day, I want to raise children who do raise their hand and say, I would like to see evidence for this. I would like to see the proof of this, because more and more common phenomenon in our society is people make declarative assertions that the science is the science and the science is settled and you can never dare to question it. And those assertions are backed up by force.
Yeah. And some of that science, I mean, is so draconian. I mean, unbelievable that you are masking children during COVID for 8 hours,
and 2 years old.
I mean, it's just, it's unthinkable, but it's done under the rubric of science.
Yeah, I was going to sign my, we are in the year 2023, summer of 2023. I tried to sign my daughter up for a summer camp at the University of Maryland. The entomology program has a bug camp. My daughter really likes bugs. On their website, and I emailed them and asked them if it was an error and outdated, and they never respond to me. On the University of Maryland entomology summer camp, bug camp, you have to wear masks all the time indoors. KN95 are strongly, emphatically preferred. It says that in the messaging. And you have to be completely up to date on all of the vaccinations. So the moment that you're eligible for a booster at 9 years old, you have to have gotten boosted. So I think at this point, if my kids had gotten all of the boosters and all of the vaccinations, we would be on booster number 3, probably, right? Is that what we're on now?
I think so. I quit at 1.
I mean, I'm good at 0, but my 9-year-old.
I had to do it because I was traveling and, you know, I was compelled to do it. Otherwise, I couldn't do international travel. But anyway, yes.
Yeah, no, compelled to do it is absolutely right. So I'm looking at this list of requirements because I was so flabbergasted. And I'm going to email them this afternoon and say, like, is this accurate? Is this still the case? But you have to be completely up to date on all the boosters and wear a 95 all day long inside in the year 2023. And last summer, I signed them up for a violin summer camp and pulled them out on the first day of camp in the year 2022 because they required masks in and outdoors in Washington, D.C.
I'm so glad you did that. I want to jump to chapter 4. I love the title, When Mickey and Scholastic Went Woke, Scholastic being a large publishing company. The question I want to ask you about this is a question that you actually articulate in the book and then answer. You ask this question, how does the most wholesome, family-friendly entertainment company, beloved for multiple generations, go completely off the rails?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting phenomenon. And there are so many components of our book that we felt like could be their own books. And the downfall of Disney will one day be a book. There will come a time when people stop going to the theme parks. And I think that Disney is relying on its place in American society where it is beloved and we all grew up with it. And so, I mean, you and I both. And, you know, it's the same idea. Freedom is only one generation away from extinction, and Disney is only one generation away from extinction. And for a lot of children, my children included, whereas we might go to a theme park although we probably never will again. We've been once. We will probably never go again because we can't afford it. It's thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to bring your kids for this very overstimulating day. And it's not really worth it, in my opinion. So there's an entire generation of children who can't afford to go to the parks and are being fed entertainment that is highly, highly ideological and not entertaining as a result. Those are linked. When your focus is on producing a product that fits DEI checkpoints and that shoves in sort of woke storylines in ways that are not natural and not interesting and not entertaining, when that is your focus, instead of producing really good children's content and children's media, which is a hard thing to do, it's not good anymore. And so you see the box office numbers for a lot of recent Disney movies, and they're not good because people are not interested in watching it. And so there's going to be an entire generation of children who are not going to grow up on Disney because their parents are uninterested or can't afford it. And, you know, I'm really pleased by the success of the Mario movie because it was just wholesome and fun and family friendly the whole way around. And I don't think that people in the industry can say, oh, you know, the market is changing. And they're like, no, the market's not changing. Disney changed. And Disney decided that they should follow the advice of people who don't have children and don't have families and who live on the coasts in these super woke enclaves. And they've decided that all of this content needs to fit their sensibilities instead of the sensibilities of 95% of American parents.
Yeah, well said. That's a great answer. And that chapter is worth the price of admission. I want to talk for a few moments about something you write about in the book, and that is the American Library Association. One of the things noted in the book is that it has as president a self-proclaimed lesbian Marxist. The workshops that are described in your book, and I thought I knew it all until I read your book, the workshops are almost beyond belief. I mean, can you imagine your six kids being subjected to one of these workshops?
Yeah, no, absolutely. A lot of that chapter was on the backs of the great reporting at The Federalist from Joy Pullman. She really had her eye on this target before a lot of people did, myself included. And so I want to give her that credit because she had people in the library system and in the library profession coming to her saying like, oh my God, this is over the top and insane. And the content that they're seeing in library school to get their MA in library science, and then in the professional association, all of that is trickling down into libraries around the country. And, you know, when I was writing that chapter on books, I felt, this sounds like really sappy and dorky, but I felt sort of the hand of God writing that chapter because in the span of 1 week, and it was, I had very carefully timed how I was researching and writing chapters so that I wouldn't fall behind on my deadline. And so the 1 week that I'm really researching this very heavily, I got a text from two different friends on different parts of the country, one in Denver and one in Pikesville outside of Baltimore. And both of them sent me a picture of the same picture book that was on display in the children's section of their library. And it was called How Mamas Love Their Babies. You've read the book, so I don't want to give you this pop quiz, but I don't know if you remember it, so maybe I will. Do you remember the sort of storyline of that book and what the message about that is?
I do not.
It's really fun. This is one of my favorite things.
I actually haven't read the book.
Oh, well, how mamas love their babies.
Oh, I actually read about it, but I didn't actually read the book itself.
Well, there's no need to read it. So the book is about how different mothers care for their children.
You could be a sex worker.
That's exactly right. And so they picked up this book and even the art and even the aesthetic feels very red light district. Neon, a lot of shadows, a lot of contrasts. It felt like picking up a pamphlet from Times Square from 1980. And that was the vibe they got instantly. And their sort of their radars went up to like, what is this book in the children's section? And they both sent me pictures of the contents of the book and said, oh my God, this was on display in the library. It wasn't June. It was just there's a lot of objectionable content that pops up in children's shelves during Pride Month, but this was not June. but this is what was on display in two children's departments. And the publisher of this book, it's not Scholastic, it's like a very small academic publisher who their sort of stated goal is to normalize the acceptance of sex work among children. And that's the stated goal of the author as well. This is the power of the libraries. This book has become amplified to such a degree that, first of all, it has a banner on Amazon. It's a teacher's pick. That's one of the books on Amazon that the teachers are like, this is great. And even though 99% of parents would never purchase this book for their personal library, it's become a real powerhouse in the children's book industry because so many library systems are using our tax dollars to buy it. And so, you know, I, on one of my other side projects is I'm an editor for a children's book series called Heroes of Liberty. And so we produce books like this on Douglas MacArthur, Ronald Reagan, John Wayne, Margaret Thatcher, Amy Coney Barrett, Thomas Sowell. Those are some of our titles. We have an uphill battle because libraries have to be literally forced to buy our books. People have tried to donate them to schools. There was a story here where I live in Montgomery County where I literally have a box of these books at my house. And I was like, I'll try to donate some of them to my local school district and see what happens. And the school district said, no, we will not accept this donation. And an intrepid local blogger filed a records request and asked the school district why. You have to fill out a form anytime an offer like this is made, and you have to fill out a form that explains your decision-making process. And on the form, when he did the records request, it was written, the book series is too patriotic. That was why the school district turned it down. And so small publishing companies like us at Heroes of Liberty are at a severe disadvantage because my local library system owns 63 copies of anti-racist board book for babies. Just the board book. That's not the book. That's just the board book for babies. Anti-racist baby, they own 63 copies of it. And so his publisher is getting the financial signal from library systems across the country that this can be a bestseller if you appeal to the librarians. Whereas they're not getting those signals from books like ours because they know they can only sell one copy to one family. And so the publishing industry is facing these financial incentives paid for with our tax dollars that incentivize books like Anti-Racist Board Baby instead of like a beautifully illustrated biography of Douglas MacArthur.
I want to get a little personal with you and ask you to help people understand what's possible. You're the mother of six children. You don't send your kids off to school. You homeschool your kids. You get your work done in the morning or however long it takes. You're writing other books. You're doing all kinds of stuff. And then you take them out to some exhibit and you teach them. You're involved in the education of your children. You're not handing your kids over to someone else to educate them. And, you know, obviously reading about you, I became an instant fan and know what that's like because my wife is my hero. She's raised incredible kids, and she's invested her life in those kids as opposed to having someone else raise them. And I'm asking you this on a personal level to talk to people so that they understand what's possible. I mean, you had a very tough upbringing by any standard, and you're candid about it in the book. And yet you are now wholesome, raising wholesome kids. It's obviously not easy. I mean, I've seen it firsthand. I mean, my wife has done the yeoman share of the work while I've been getting plaudits from people around the world. You're raising kids, you're educating them, but there's a satisfaction in that. I mean, it's not like some draconian measure that you've taken on because you have to do it, but you're actually enjoying the process. Am I overstating it?
No, not at all. I think that a lot of the, and sort of in the lead up to Mother's Day, we're going to hear a lot of this messaging that mothers are martyrs and mothers are like, they're heroes. And like, yes, is motherhood hard? Yes. Like, have I slept in 10 years? Not really. I aspire to sleep again one day. But at the end of the day, I don't do this because I am a glutton for punishment. I do it because my children bring me deep satisfaction and deep joy. And this is messaging that, and this is actually the next book project that I'm sort of noodling on right now and mulling over is how to sort of package this and write it, but how the left has messaged motherhood in a way that, and the right as well, honestly, I don't think that we're faultless in this, has made it so that it's completely unappealing. We don't want people to enter into this. And I've heard from so many people that, you know, they put off motherhood for a really long time because they wanted to gain fulfillment out of other aspects of their lives, whether it be their travels or their professional life or whatever. And then they finally had their first kid at like 35, 36. And they realized like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is delightful. My friend Megan McCain talks about this a lot because she's like, oh wow, motherhood is like a dream. And I wish that I had realized this before now, because a lot of people are stuck when they start at 35 and they can't have more than two or three kids. The statistics indicate that most women are unhappy with their childbearing reality, not their decisions, but their reality. A lot of women want to have more children than they have. And I think a lot of that is because women are sort of told that motherhood is a misery, and it's really not. I think that one of the strange gifts of my childhood was that, you know, it was so hard and it was very sad and very lonely and not good. Just zero stars on my childhood, I have to say, in my teen years. But the gift of that is that I deeply appreciate life in a way that I don't think that I would otherwise. And I'm so fulfilled by my children and by spending my days with them. Children are, for better or for worse, reflections of their parents. And so I see this phenomenon a lot in parenting, mothering, honestly, mother Facebook groups where people say, like, they'll sort of sound off to a group of like 16,000 people, and all of whom are strangers, and they'll say, my kid, I can't stand my kid. He's so disrespectful. He's such a jerk. This is the thing he did. He doesn't respect me. He's such a brat. And I'm, you know, that person who raises her hand just to cause trouble. But I comment always, I'm like, where do you think they learned it? They learned it from you. This is how you disrespect your child, by publicly putting them on blast to 16,000 strangers in order to accomplish what? Like, you're venting about them, embarrassing them, and shaming them. They are a person. That is a person worthy of respect. And if you've never shown them respect, of course they're not going to mirror it back to you. And so I've noticed in so many ways, my children are little clones of me, both my sons and my daughters, more my daughters than my sons. And it makes me realize, like, oh, these are my faults. I'm a little bossy. I'm a little micromanagey because I see my kids being like that. But I also see them as being deeply empathetic, wonderful people with such, I mean, yesterday at the park, we were walking up the staircase into the park, and there were some boys chasing after a family of geese, chasing them and teasing them. And my daughter, my 9-year-old, was in tears. She was so angry. She was so like indignant that they would treat God's creatures like this. And she was about to go up to them and yell at them. And she was 10 steps ahead of me, and I was catching up in order to do the same. And we were headed off by the rabbi of their school who did it first. But I am raising amazing people, and they are a reflection of the work that we are putting into it. And I'm glad that we're putting the work into it, because it's, you know, the dividends are astronomical. But I think a lot of people don't see the forest through the trees. And I think a lot of that is because they're getting constant negative messaging about motherhood. And it's hard to see the positive when all you're focused on is the negative.
I'm so glad I asked you that question. That's a wonderful response. I don't want to continue cursing the darkness, because your book not only curses the darkness appropriately, but it builds a lighthouse. But I do want people to know what's out there, like Genderqueer or the issue of Nickelodeon, a show marketed for preschoolers that features an animated pride parade that's led by an American drag queen. This is now in the water. I mean, it's become part of the culture.
It's mainstream.
It's mainstream. And I think you're saying that despite that, you see a glimmer of hope. You see that we're coming to a place where there's going to be pushback.
I think so. I think that I am hopeful that this response to the Bud Light incident was very, very forceful. And I'm also hopeful that, you know, people are paying more attention to their children's schooling and getting involved in school boards. And I'm also really, really inspired by how many parents are deciding to just check out of the system completely and homeschool. The numbers of homeschoolers has skyrocketed. And one of my other side projects, I promise I do parent my children, but I also have a lot of side projects. One of my other side projects, I don't sleep. That's the answer. I don't sleep. But one of the other side projects that I
you and my wife Kathy would get along very, very well because she doesn't sleep very much either.
There's just so much I want to do.
Yeah.
So one of my side projects is currently an Instagram account. We're going to launch it into a full Substack, and it's called Write Books for Kids. And it's the number four, Write Books for Kids. And we're sort of, myself and another homeschool mom, Rachel Reeves, are highlighting all of the quality children's literature that we can find. And we're also putting a spotlight on the negative and trying to educate parents about sort of these hidden demons that are within. And that hidden demons is like a quote from a middle grade author who is trying with all of her energy to get her wholesome books published. And she's being told by editors and her agent, like, if you have an LGBT character, I can sell this to a publishing house. There are literal demons hidden within a lot of these modern day books. And so, you know, we're trying to highlight the good and to educate parents, and the enthusiasm on this Instagram account is such that we're building a Substack out of it. Like, we've decided, like, there's so much of an audience of parents, mostly mothers, but also fathers, who are passionate about what their children are reading, that they feel like they need to subscribe to this content in order to fulfill their children's literary needs. And I talk about books, and I'm passionate about books, and it's why, like, so much of what I do is children's books related, whether it be like Heroes of Liberty or this Instagram account. I talk about it in terms of diet. And I homeschool according to the Charlotte Mason method, which is like very heavy on literature. And she talks about it as a feast. You're laying a feast of ideas in front of your children. And when it comes to books, a lot of parents have the philosophy that, like, as long as my kid is reading, I don't care what it is. And people are starting to realize that, as with food, it matters more than just that your child is eating. It matters what they're eating. You can't feed them poison. You can't feed them junk food. You have to feed them nutritious content on a daily basis, 3 times a day, in order to grow their body. And you have to feed them nutritious, healthy content for their minds in order to grow not just their brains and not just their intellect, but also their soul. This is the formation of your soul. If you think about the books that you grew up with and how that changed who you are as a person, there's something inside of you that is touched. I mean, if you think about Chronicles of Narnia, this here is my mother's set that she was given by her father. I was only allowed to read it if I would bring the individual book in a Ziploc bag and promise to wash my hands before eating it. That was the only way I was allowed to bring these books to school when I was a kid. And I so vividly remember reading The Exile from Narnia when each kid grew too old for Narnia and they left Narnia. And it still makes me want to cry thinking about it as a 37-year-old woman. These are the books that shape your soul. And you cannot just feed them genderqueer, or they're going to grow up into shallow shells of humans instead of like fully formed human beings with soul and character. This is character building.
Yeah, your intellectual curiosity, I'm sure, came in part from reading Tolkien or C.S. Lewis. You know, I often think about the fact that we become wretched flatlanders. We can't go beyond the wardrobe and step into Narnia and see that there's a whole world around us that is not just based on molecules in motion.
Yeah, no, and then I think that there is a revival of a lot of these ideas and a lot of these thoughts. The Charlotte Mason, who I talked about a second ago, I mean, she's from the turn of the century and her books had to be put into reprint. And now the ideas of this very long dead philosopher in England. I think that she died in like 18, I don't remember, but her ideas are facing such a revival among parents now in 2023, because we're realizing like there has to be something more, there has to be something deeper. And so I think that one of my favorite people who talks about this a lot is Andrew Clavin and his son, I forget his first name.
Spencer?
Spencer, thank you.
I had him on my podcast. Great guy. Yeah.
Good. He's
very
fantastic.
Smart. Yeah.
He just wrote a new book also.
Yeah.
But both Clavin, Spencer and Andrew, talk a lot about reviving ancient art and ancient literature and ancient thought and philosophy and making it attainable and accessible to us now. And Spencer just wrote a fantastic new book about how we sort of save the West with ancient ideas. And he is able to publish a book like that because I think there is an audience for it.
Yeah. I think you pointed out in your book that even the Tolkien Society is capitulating mm-hmm. to some degree to
yes.
the woke worldview. They're getting into the diversity, inclusion,
equity inclusion.
Enterprise. So you had to be concerned about that somewhat. There's a lot of capitulation going on. But I want to move on to chapter 5 of your book, The Peril of Woke Medicine. That is an incredibly important chapter as well. And I think you're absolutely right. You could make a book out of every one of these chapters. But
yes.
discuss pediatrics being among the most left-leaning medical specialties and why that is. And when we talk about left-leaning, we're not thinking about left and right in the traditional sense. We're talking about far leftist, radical impositions of Marxist theologies.
Yeah. So when we sort of wrote the book, we wanted it to be kind of a beach read, honestly, like a book that parents could really get an overview of topics. And we also felt like a lot of these chapters, like that Disney chapter, like that medicine chapter, are whole books in themselves. The woke medicine chapter is probably my favorite of the chapters that I wrote, if I'm allowed to choose favorites, because there's a lot of parents, myself included, who feel like we are immunizing ourselves against a lot of this phenomenon by virtue of the fact that we homeschool, by virtue of the fact that my kids' favorite actor is Robin Williams, and they don't watch anything produced literally in their lifetime. But on the medical front, I observed anecdotally, so I've had a baby every other year for the last 10 years. And so when you go to the pediatrician and you fill out a form as a new patient, even though, you know, we're not new patients, but I see this form every other year is what I'm saying when I have a new baby. In the time between the birth of my fourth child, who was born almost 4 years ago, and my fifth child, who was born almost 2 years ago, so about 3 years ago, probably, the form changed. And the question of sex of the child was then preceded by, what is your child's gender identity? And that is a new question on the form at my pediatrician within the last 3 years. And that chapter, I sort of endeavor to show how on every step of a doctor, in this case, a pediatrician's professional life, they are forced to adhere to this worldview in order to get to the next level on the career ladder. And so I was sent the questions by a med school applicant, by his husband, and his husband sent me like, these are the questions that my husband had to answer at University of Wisconsin, at like all of these different universities around the country. And the first round of questions is like really generalized. And then when you pass that first round and you get into the second round, you have to answer essay questions. And the essay questions are like, how will you advance social justice in your practice as a doctor? And so you have to answer those questions adequately in order to then get admitted into medical school. I spoke to a professor at a medical school who felt like he was being policed by his own students when it came to DEI topics. He felt like he was entrapped in one circumstance by students who wanted to make sure that he was parroting sort of the PC party line as far as woke talking points go. And so even a professor feels like he has to toe the line, and the students do as well, for sure. And then once they graduate, most jobs in the medical world are within hospital systems. Hospital systems control the vast majority of the market share in the medical industry, in the healthcare world. And they have HR departments who adhere to this stuff as well. And a lot of the doctors, the practicing doctors that I spoke with, cited that fact as to why they couldn't go on the record, because they couldn't run afoul of their HR person at their hospital system. So then they go to a conference and they're getting to continuing education in their line of work. One of the more powerful parts of that chapter, in my opinion, was a conference where they were giving sort of best practices that are very evolving and change on a year-to-year basis about how to adequately care for children who are born severely prematurely, like 25 weeks, for example. And that science changes on a yearly basis, which is why the odds of survival are getting better and better. It's because the medical science is advancing. And medical science is advancing because people are sitting down and having conversations about best practices. And so at a conference where they were going to have a conversation like that, where experts were going to sort of sit on high and say, here's the data, here's what works. This is what works in our hospitals. This is what works in our practice. These are the trials that we've run, all these things. And a panel at a conference about that subject was canceled because there was a Twitter mob that formed against the organizers of that conference because they realized that all of the experts on that panel were white men. And so that was objectionable enough that they got the panel canceled. And so in the future, not just this medical organization, but every medical organization that witnessed this happen, is that they have to choose continuing education panels, not based on their expertise, but instead on their identity, whether it be their gender identity, their racial identity. And the result is you're going to have people providing continuing education to medical professionals who are not necessarily experts in their fields, but who just happen to be like a Marxist Black lesbian.
You know what's so interesting about that, or maybe terrifying about that? You think about this in an area like pediatrics, but you can also take this now and transpose it in your mind to the FAA or to pilots.
Mm-hmm. And that's happening.
If identity trumps expertise, I mean, you can have... Yeah, where are the guardrails?
Yep, they're all off. They're all off. I think it's United, right? This happened with recently?
I didn't hear about that, but it could be.
Yes, no, you are correct. Hold on.
I was simply talking about this from a hypothetical standpoint, but it's not hypothetical anymore.
No, this is not hypothetical. There was a story in 2021, April of 2021, United Airlines pushes for 20% of their trainee pilots to be people of color or women, and they're not choosing pilots based on their expertise, but at least 50% of them based on their identity, whether they be women or people of color. And when you focus on identity instead of competence and safety, the result is you're going to see more plane crashes.
And not only that, but I mean, getting back to medicine, I think what happens to a culture when identity trumps expertise is you start, at least intuitively, having questions about the medical industry as a whole. So now you don't trust what you once trusted. And I think that's worrisome in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you, I trust the medical establishment a great deal less than I used to. When I have to fight in order to bring my 2.5-year-old into a doctor's office without having to wear a mask, that doesn't work and that does nothing to protect her or anyone else, I lose faith in that medical provider. No two ways about it. I have lost a lot of faith in a lot of people over the course of the last 3 years. That cloth mask on my 2-year-old did not do anything.
Yeah, exactly. Chapter 6, Transgender Crusade. You see kids being used as guinea pigs. And the obvious question is, how does the onslaught of sex and fear that young people are experiencing today change the developing brain?
Yeah, I mean, so that to me is one of the most interesting questions that will never be asked among researchers. But it 10 years ago would have been a sociological experiment that would never have been granted approval on the grounds of ethics. But we're raising an entire generation of children now who are being stripped of their very basic right, in my opinion, to understand the world in very concrete ways. And so, I mean, you have double the number of children that I have when kids are first trying to make sense of the world at about 2 or 3 years old, one of the first ways that they do that is by creating categories. And in our house, it sounds like, and I think everyone's house, it sounds like mommy is a girl, daddy is a boy. My sister is a girl, my brother is a boy. Bubby is a girl, Zadie is a boy. And that's how they sort of gain an understanding of this world that they've like found themselves in and they're trying to make sense of. Now we're telling children, well, Bubby could decide to be a boy one day and she could just do that. And so Bubby being a girl isn't a concrete set in stone thing. And to take that rug out from under children and to read them books about Jacob's New Dress, which is a book in the children's section, that strips children of their ability to understand the world around them in a really profound and fundamental way. And I don't know what, I mean, we have never in human history done that to a child. I don't know what that does to a developing brain. And it is a sociological experiment that we will see the results of. If I were to venture a prediction, all of these efforts are producing a generation and generations, you know, everyone's growing up little by little every year, but every single year we're seeing the rates of depression, anxiety, you name it, all of these mental health crises among children accelerating at an extremely rapid clip. And it is intertangled with all of this. This idea that there is no ground on which to stand is very anxiety inducing and very depressing as well. So of course, children are growing up into teenagers and teenagers are growing up into adults who are experiencing more mental health crises as a result.
And this is happening so early on in the development of a child. And that's part of the strategy, because once a child starts to recognize that I really am not a girl, if they're a boy or vice versa, because their hips are different than a boy's hips would be or whatever. So what I'm getting at with this question is expanding on the fact that kids are being targeted with puberty blockers and all these kinds of things at a very early age before they can see with their own eyes that, hey, this isn't reality. I mean, in my worldview, the soul is not sexed. It's the body that is sexed.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And they sort of, they've tried to lie and say that brain science indicates that transgender brains are different and that we all have different brains. That is not backed up by brain scans. That's not backed up by science. They've just completely made that up. And they're doing this, they're targeting very young children because their brains are still developing. And so it is much easier to tell a three-year-old that Bubby can become Zadie than to tell a 30-year-old that. A 30-year-old has a much more in-tune BS radar than a three-year-old. You can lie to a three-year-old very easily, and I do every single day. That's a toy museum. That's not a toy store. I don't know what you're talking about. There's no ice cream at it. You don't smell chocolate on my breath. That's something else. That's not coffee. Lying to children is very easy. Thank God. God made them very gullible. But that gullibility is being targeted by the left in order to perpetuate this ideology, because this is a very powerful chapter that Carol wrote. This is how Marxist societies have always tried to advance their ideologies. It's by targeting children.
Just a simple question, but why in the world do parents allow their children to be experimented on? I mean, how can a parent do that?
So there was a really, really powerful article on the cover of Commentary Magazine in the month of May. Perhaps it was April, but I think it was the May issue of Commentary Magazine by Liel Liebowitz. He is a writer at Tablet Magazine. And he wrote this article that has really stayed with me for a very long time since reading it. And he basically compared it to pagan societies of the past and child sacrifice. And I can't stop thinking about that article. And I think that in a lot of ways, COVID, when I was growing up, I would learn about things like the Khmer Rouge. And I would wonder, like, how does no one say anything? You would read stories like The Emperor's New Clothes and wonder, like, how does no one say anything? That's absurd. When COVID happened, it was like this eye-opening, oh, that's how it happens. That's how no one says anything. That's how these atrocities happen with millions of people around who think that they are good and decent. And I think that how parents allow it to happen is they are fearful and they are subjecting themselves and their children to powerful groupthink and peer pressure. But I think that in a lot of ways, we feel like our society is advanced way more than it is. And, you know, you read about sort of lobotomies of the past and think, oh, thank God, medicine and psychiatry is a better place. But like, is it though? No, it's not. Are we better than the child sacrificers of the Aztecs? I don't think so.
Wow. You know, in that vein, I wanted to ask you what it would take for the leader of the free world to grease the skids for the greatest assault on human nature in the history of humanity. And I'm talking about the Justice Department sending a letter to the state attorney generals saying that they could be violating civil rights law if they deny gender-affirming care. Again, we probably ought to put that in scare quotes, gender-affirming care to children.
Yeah.
So here you have a letter from the Justice Department to state attorney generals saying that they could be violating civil rights law if they deny gender-affirming care to children. I mean, it seems almost beyond the pale.
It's really terrifying. And that is the moment where people need to recognize that this is not fringe. Your family is not safe. And there's a lot of these attempts by, not attempts, I mean, successful efforts on the part of incredibly powerful politicians like Biden, like the Attorney General, like the governor of Washington State, the governor of California. These are the mechanisms of the state coming for children. This is state-sponsored child sacrifice. I mean, literally, Aztecs. Like, the comparisons are, like, mind-boggling.
Yeah. I want to read something. This is a quote from your book. The Leon County Schools Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, Gender Nonconforming, and Questioning Support Guide. So this is an actual guide. Includes these 3 points. Parents not to be informed. We're talking about kids being groomed on campus here. The children allowed to choose from gendered restroom to use. And the third point in this guide, children told to keep their gender and sexual identity secret from their parents.
Yeah, so this is sort of harkening back to that earlier thing that I said about how parents are having their children being told by outside adults in positions of authority to take the decision-making and the just knowledge about their children's sexual existence and sexual activities away from the parents and to hide it. And that is endangering children and making them more susceptible to abuse, either at the hands of the people who are doing it now or at, you know, the future hands of people who, you know, are thus far unknown. But it's teaching children also to keep secrets, and it's a really scary...
It's pitting the children against their parents, really.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, again, like, you saw that in Soviet Russia, and that was an incredibly powerful part of what Carol wrote about also was, you know, this was a phenomenon that her grandparents talked about a great deal with her parents sort of being encouraged to become informers on their parents.
Chapter 7, Sexualized Childhood. How did we get to the place where pedophilia is just another sexual orientation? In fact, now there's an acronym for it, MAPS, Minor
MAPS,
Attracted
yeah.
Persons. So it yep. takes the horror of pedophilia and it cloaks it under an umbrella that sounds palatable.
Yeah. So that was probably the hardest chapter to write because I have this gut instinct. It was hard at that moment. There's been more evidence that has emerged since I wrote that chapter, but it was hard to buttress that chapter enough to get it to a place where I felt like it was fact-checked enough to be published as a book. But sort of my gut instinct on that chapter and what I tried to portray in that chapter was that you know, this idea that if we're positing that a child is able to determine their sexual identity at the age of three, I mean, this is something that we're told, that a child can declare their gender identity and their sexual orientation at 3 years old. If they can make that determination on their gender and sexual identity at that young age, what prevents them? So they have a sexual orientation, even though they do not yet have a fully formed sexual identity because they're not sexualized beings. So therefore, why can't they be sexual beings? If they already have a gender identity and a sexual identity, then they are therefore sexual beings and can be sexualized. And so if a child, if a male three-year-old can decide that they are now a girl, they're female, why can't they decide to engage in consensual sex? Where's this line? I mean, you referenced it earlier, what are the guardrails? What are the guardrails here? If a child can decide their gender identity, why can't a child decide to enter into a consensual sexual relationship? I would love to ask that question of someone who adheres to this worldview. And, you know, we're sort of portrayed as, you know, crazy and bigots and, you know, of course that's not where we're headed. Why not? Why can't that be where we're headed?
Bethany, I've been doing this for over 40 years, and I remember talking on one of my broadcasts with someone who's an expert in this field. And we used to say, you know, there's a slippery slope here, and that slippery slope will eventually get to pedophilia. And then we would talk off air and say, you know what, maybe that was a little extreme. We look at that now and say, no, that was absolutely the end goal. Sexualizing children. And I think something that's even more dramatic in terms of what you have written, and in this case, Carol wrote the chapter, Child Soldiers, where kids actually become the very provocateurs in the fight. They are raised up. They are used as puppets, so to speak, because if a kid says something, who dares take on the kid? Otherwise, you're really going to be criticized because here you are criticizing a young kid.
Yeah. I mean, that chapter, the title of that chapter, Child Soldiers, was the working title of the book. That was a huge foundation of our thinking on that. And that chapter was probably the one that we worked on together the most because we felt like that was the whole objective of this movement, was to turn children into child soldiers and to strip them of their resilience and their innocence and transform them into mindless robots and, you know, warriors for the left and their causes.
And
like
Greta
climate change, like guns.
Yeah.
Greta Thunberg, yes.
Yeah, I mean, she's the poster child for it. I mean, and the reward for the child is amazing. You can say the most absurd things without any basis in reality whatsoever, but now you're nominated for a Nobel Prize, you speak at the United Nations. The plaudits that come with this are incredible. So there's an incentive in some way for a parent to let their child be used in this way.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There absolutely is. And there was a story that came out on the New York Post, and there's an actress named Marcia Gay Harden. And she has three children, and all three of them, what are the odds, right? This is what Jordan Peterson says, like, what are the odds? All three of her children identify as queer. One of them is non-binary, one of them is something else, but all three of her children are queer. And for this, she gets plaudits. She gets like, wow, you are so accepting. You're such an amazing mom. I can't. You're so wonderful that all three of your children feel so comfortable because you've made them feel so comfortable. One of the therapists that I spoke to for this book said it's Munchausen. That's what a lot of this is. There's a lot of parents out there. I mean, this sort of goes back to our child sacrifice conversation. There are a lot of parents who feel validation because they have their own mental health issues. They're getting outside validation from friends, family, Facebook, who knows? I mean, this is like the Jazz Jennings the very famous young man who decided he was a woman when he was very, very, very young, and his mother became a stage mom. And all of these parents are getting this external validation by feeding this messaging to their children. And they are sacrificing their children to the altar of this. And it's not just gender. It's also Greta Thunberg with climate change. And, you know, parents who bring their kids to gun control rallies, they are sacrificing their children's mental health and hope in the future. And they're pumping them with fear in order to get them to be fully participatory in this expression of their own political identity.
You know what is terrifying about all of this, Bethany, is this was part of the Nazi playbook, to take children and make them soldiers for your revolution. Anti-Semitism, I mean, it didn't come out of the clear blue sky. For children, they were taught anti-Semitic rhetoric in the schools, sometimes in the churches. And so the children became foot soldiers for the revolution. And to see that today in real life in the 21st century in America ought to be terrifying.
No, and it is. And this sort of, this is the question of, you know, how did that happen? And I'm Jewish. I'm very reticent to compare anything to Nazi Germany. But on the question of how does this happen as a society, I think that it's very illustrative, because we are seeing how does an entire society perpetuate evil and have everyone go along with it. And I think that we're seeing that now, that the answer is this present moment.
The answer is this present moment. That's right. I want you to address how a child can get away from the victim mentality. I forget exactly the quote, but somewhere in your book, you say that there's a little line on a mirror. So when you look in the mirror, you're saying you're looking at the most wonderful person in the world. And you say, that's not self-esteem, that's narcissism. You call it out for what it is.
Yeah. I mean, the question of how do you raise children to not subscribe to this worldview? I mean, the number one answer is always don't send them to an indoctrination factory. Don't send them to a place where 8 hours a day they're being fed falsehoods. But I think that a lot of the answer is just trying to raise decent people, and decency and reality hold hands. And so when you're raising a child who is not afraid to be the person who stands up and says the emperor has no clothes, when you're raising a child who reads great literature that challenges them to be better people with an intact and firm moral compass, you can protect your children from this ideology. But it's not easy. One of the other questions that we got from an editor when we were trying to sell this book project was, well, can you tone down the fight message? And our answer was no. The last word in our book is the word fight. And the answer to how do you raise children who don't subscribe to this worldview is you can't stop fighting. And you have to fight for that individual child. But you also have to fight for childhood as an institution and as a collective identity. Oh, all of us had that identity as a child. And now, in so many different ways, we're being told that children are just small adults, and we're being told to raise them to think and to operate as small adults and small people, and to be reasoned with as small adults and small people. That's like the parenting messaging we're getting from the experts, like in air quotes, about parenting. But you'd have to just fight. There's going to be a million big and small battles that parents have to engage in order to try to battle against this ideology. At the end of the day, if you look at who is having children, it's people who have faith and who are hopeful about the future. And those are not people who subscribe to this woke worldview. And so we are the people who are having children. You have 12, we have 6. Right there, that's like, you know, what, 2 classrooms of kids?
It's a state.
Yeah. And they're not having children. And so their goal is to indoctrinate our children. And we have to stop them.
So let's end it with this. I thought the book was brilliant in that it has two conclusions, one by Carol, one by Bethany. Your conclusion, her conclusion. It's sort of interesting, your comment on those two conclusions. One is that you change the system from within. You don't leave it, like, for example, leave the school system. You change it from within. The other is, no, you've got to pull your kids out of that school system because those kids are guaranteed casualties if you don't.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're collateral damage. And I love and respect Carol, and her children are all wonderful. And those children are a product of her and her husband's upbringing. And so I think that she's wrong that you can stay within this system and produce children of her children's caliber. I think they are an exception. And I think they are exceptional children. They are exceptional because of their mother and their father. But I think that most people are not Carol Markowitz. Most people are not able to fight and to stay connected and stay on top of their children's education to the degree that Carol does in order to ensure the end product as good as her children. I think that the more realistic solution is to pull kids out of these systems because we do have to transform them. But in the meantime, we cannot let our children become collateral damage.
Well, you are even more wonderful than I thought you'd be. I love your book. Really resonate with the experience of interacting with you. I think you're brilliant. Stolen Youth, it is available for anyone who stands shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. You can get your copy on the web at equip.org, EQUIP.org, or you can write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. Once again, Bethany, thank you so much for your time, for your contribution. You're making a difference while there's yet time.
Yeah, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
It's a true pleasure. And I want to thank everybody for tuning into this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. If you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe, rate, review. That helps a lot. Look forward to seeing you next time with more of Hank Unplugged. So long for now.